defeated. Or maybe you are not telling the truth, I retorted. At the close of my cross-examination, Arius stood and performed her redirect examination. Through a series of simply worded questions, Arius worked to re-establish that Niederauer had indeed been the one who had written the messages in Digital Photo Pro and the corresponding page numbers in Star. But after failing in her attempt to rehabilitate her witness, she tried to place the blame on me for Niederauer's erroneous statement that she had circled those numbers. So I don't recall you saying that you circled the pages in the interview. Juan said that. I was prepared for the fight, and before Arius could even finish her sentence, I stood to voice my objection. I am going to object to the defendant testifying, I declared. The record speaks for itself. Okay, Arius acknowledged, shrinking back on that accusation to put forth another equally improbable excuse. Is it possible you're mixed up?
Yes,
Niederauer said, grabbing the bait. You don't remember exactly when you wrote in the magazine? Arius coached, prompting me to object once again. Sustained, Judge Stevens ruled, and directed Arius to rephrase her question. This was the first hearing at which I cross-examined a witness presented by Arius and in her presence, so she hadn't known how to prepare Niederauer for my manner of questioning. Niederauer's account did not hold up under scrutiny, and the testimony ended up assisting the prosecution. More than that, the experience proved useful in other ways. After years of seeing how Arius manipulated situations and people to her advantage, it was instructive to watch as she floundered in a courtroom where rules are non-negotiable. After Niederauer stepped down from the witness stand, the hearing was continued until August 15th, when I was expected to call the remaining witnesses and Arius would question them, continuing to act as her own lawyer. But when we arrived on August 15th to resume the hearing, there was a change in the proceedings. Arius had chosen to stop representing herself, and after the reappointment of Nurmi and Washington as defense counsel, I was surprised when they withdrew their objection to my request that the letters be excluded from use during the trial. And with that, the letters were gone from the case. Even though Nurmi had claimed to Sky Hughes that the authenticity of the letter he showed her had been verified by a handwriting expert, this claim had fallen apart under closer scrutiny. It was an abrupt reversal, and defense counsel never gave a reason to the court for their decision agreeing to withdraw the letters. Whatever the defense counsel's rationale for withdrawing them, the case had a new reality. Without the Bob White letters to aid her, Arius's claim of self-defense was weakened substantially, because it was based solely on her uncorroborated word. She had painted herself into a corner with her different stories, and now had no choice but to stay the course with this one. Chapter 12. Though I'd successfully dealt with the Bob White letters, they were only part of the problem. I still had to contend with the instant messages and various electronic communications that portrayed Travis as someone who was quick to anger and used sexually offensive language toward Arius. These messages and words were probably going to be admissible, and they seemed to support Arius's claim that Travis could be verbally and physically abusive, and, at times, sexually inappropriate. I needed to find a way to counter this interpretation of the messages. Rather than challenging Travis's written words, I chose to focus on what might have provoked his angry missives, which meant looking more closely at his constant antagonist, Jody Arius. There had to be a reason, even a bad one, to help explain his harsh written outbursts. In Arius's telling, Travis was the sexual aggressor of the two, while she was the more passive one, a self-characterization that helped form the foundation of her self-defense argument. The electronic correspondence showed them both to be sexually aggressive in their own ways, and a different story of what was going on between them appeared to unfold. Travis may have had his moments of harsh words for Arius, but his messages like, three-hole wonder did not seem indicative of his behavior throughout their relationship. Those harsh moments were just that. Moments. They showed all too clearly that there were times when Arius could push Travis too far, and like anyone pushed so hard, he got angry. Combined with the shame and guilt that he was already feeling toward himself as a religious person in this highly sexual relationship, there were times when her antagonism resulted in words that he couldn't take back. This didn't make his lashing out acceptable on any level, but viewed through this lens, it was clear that these charged moments of anger were the exceptions, not the rule. In order to counter the idea that Arius was simply a passive figure and Travis a constant sexual aggressor, I needed to move beyond the instant messages and emails, which would always be open to interpretation from either side, depending on who was discussing them. I began to think back to what I knew of her previous relationships. I remembered reading something which spoke to Arius's demeanor in an intimate setting during the interview that the defense investigator had done with Daryl Brewer back on October 6, 2008, the interview that had first put me on the trail of the gas cans. So I pulled out the binder with his summary to verify my recollection. When the investigator had asked Brewer about his intimate relationship with Arius, Brewer had talked about when they first met. The first time, she was pretty aggressive, he recalled when speaking to the investigator, describing Arius as enthusiastic and always comfortable sexually and with intimacy. Turning this information over anew, it was intriguing how different Brewer's characterization of Arius was from the way she was portraying herself now that she was claiming she had killed Travis in self-defense. I wanted to find out if Arius had been as sexually forward with Ryan Burns as she had been with Daryl Brewer. She had visited him in Utah less than 24 hours after she'd been intimate with Travis before she killed him, so I wanted to find out how sexually appropriate she had been with Burns, especially after having rolled around in Travis's bed a day before. To prepare myself for my call to Burns, I decided to review the telephonic interview police had conducted with him on June 25, 2008. The information he had provided to them was silent with regard to any sexual interplay that he and Arius may have had. But my review was not in vain, as I did find another discrepancy in the story Arius had told Burns about why her cell phone hadn't been working during the drive from California to Utah. Burns told police that Arius called him on Tuesday, June 3, 2008, at around 11 p.m. to let him know she had just left the Monterey area and would be arriving in Utah the following day. He didn't hear from her again until approximately 20 hours later, when she phoned him the evening of June 4th, claiming to have driven in the wrong direction, gotten lost, and run out of gas. She told Burns she had just passed a highway sign that read 100 miles to Las Vegas, which would put her on Highway 93 north, passing through Kingman, Arizona. Her stated reason for not contacting Burns sooner was that she had forgotten her cell phone charger and turned off her phone to save the battery. This was in stark contrast to what she had told Detective Flores on July 15, 2008, just after her arrest in Yreka. During that conversation, Arius claimed that her cell phone had powered off on its own just east of Pasadena, California, and it wasn't until she found her cell phone charger, which had lodged itself under the passenger side seat, that she was able to power it on north of Kingman. That Arius had told two different stories about the cell phone charger, one to Burns and the other to law enforcement, during an official police interview, convinced me even more that she had deliberately powered off her cell phone to avoid being detected in Arizona. This certainly spoke to her premeditation of the murder, because it was another step she took, knowing it would be impossible for police to electronically track her movements if her phone was powered off. This became one more point I didn't want to forget to discuss with Burns on the phone. It was mid-morning when I reached Burns on his cell phone, and from the outset he sounded eager to cooperate. I explained that I had some questions for him that had not been covered during his interview with police, assuring him that I was not recording our conversation or taking notes. I avoid using a recorder when I speak with witnesses because I want them to be comfortable knowing there is no recording device, and I don't take notes because I don't want to stop the flow of the conversation by asking the person to repeat something to enable me to write it down. I am happy to tell you what I know, Burns said. I didn't want to initiate the conversation with questions about his intimate relationship with Arius, so I began by asking him about his living situation. He explained that back in June 2008, he had resided with his parents in West Jordan, a suburb of Salt Lake City, but that his quarters were private and separated from the rest of the house. Next, I asked him about Arius's failure to arrive in Utah on the morning of June 4th, as she had promised, and he indicated that he'd started to worry when she didn't turn up as scheduled. As the hours passed without hearing from her, he grew increasingly concerned and called around to mutual acquaintances in the Salt Lake City area, hoping that they had heard something. It struck me that his community was close-knit, and he felt comfortable calling others to share his concern. When he learned that no one had heard from her, there was nothing he could do but wait and hope she was okay. Burns told me that it wasn't until later that evening, while out to dinner with two friends at the Cheesecake Factory, that he finally received a call from Arius, claiming she had gotten lost and would be in Utah sometime the following morning. Burns recalled that she was in good spirits and was looking forward to seeing him. When she finally arrived the next day and greeted him outside his front door, he told me he was surprised to see that she was now a brunette, since she'd been a blonde when he first met her. "You're a lucky guy that girls come to see you," I said, trying to move the conversation to the more pertinent topic of their physical relationship. I knew that Ryan Burns was Mormon, and I wanted to be respectful, but I needed to find out what had happened during their brief time together. When I asked if they had kissed, he revealed that Arius was more than a willing participant, as she kissed him first. Burns described the kiss as passionate, so I asked him if anything else had happened. He admitted that the two had engaged in sexual behavior the only night she was in Utah. He explained that after attending a PPL meeting in Salt Lake City, the two went to dinner with friends and then back to his house, where they watched a movie together. He recalled that Arius was tired, so the two lay down on his bed for a nap so she could get a few hours of sleep before starting her drive back to California. Upon waking, according to Burns, they engaged in romantic kissing and grinding of their pelvic areas, with Arius straddling him while the two were fully clothed. Listening to Burns' narrative, it was surprising to hear that Arius would be so intimate and aggressive with him, given what, according to her, she'd just been through with Travis. After all, if her version of events was to be believed, less than 2 days earlier she'd slept with Travis, who had caused her to fear for her life to the point that she'd killed him. And yet, in spite of all this apparent emotional trauma that she'd experienced, here she was with Burns, carrying on in a sexual manner as though nothing had happened. "Did anything unusual happen while you guys were together?" I asked. It was then that Burns told me something that had not been mentioned in the police report. Shortly after Arius arrived at his house on June 5th, the two drove in separate cars to a restaurant where they were meeting friends for lunch before going to the PPL seminar. It was around noon and he was driving in front of her when he looked in his rearview mirror and noticed that she had been pulled over by a member of the West Jordan City Police Department. He watched as Arius spoke briefly with the police officer and was allowed to drive on without being cited. Once they arrived at the restaurant, Burns asked her what had happened with the cop, and she explained that he'd pulled her over because her rear license plate was affixed upside down. She claimed that some kids had been goofing around near the front of her car while she'd been inside a restaurant while driving through California. She added that when she came out to the parking lot, the kids saw her approaching, dropped the front license plate, and took off laughing. She'd picked up the plate and put it in the back seat of her car, telling Burns those kids were the ones responsible for removing the back license plate and replacing it upside down. At the end of my call with Burns, I was anxious to know more about what had happened with the traffic stop, so I attempted to get a copy of the police report detailing the events. I phoned the police station in West Jordan and was told that a report of the traffic stop had not been generated because Arias had not been cited. I know that each dispatch operator also generates another, less detailed report, and I immediately called the dispatch center and requested the event log for the traffic stop. The log did not include much information, but it did indicate the name of the police officer, Michael Gallietti, and the time of 12:03 p.m. when he had pulled Arias over on June 5th. After leaving a message for him, Officer Gallietti returned my call, and I asked about the traffic stop, hoping he remembered pulling Arias over. As it turned out, he remembered the stop quite well, saying it was the only time in his career where he had seen a car being driven with a rear license plate affixed upside down. He also said that there was no front license plate on the car when he stopped it that day, and remembered that the driver was a woman whom he identified as Jody Arias. When I asked if she had provided an explanation, he told me that during traffic stops he hears a lot of stories, and hers was that her friends, not strangers, must be playing a joke on me. It was impressive that Arias was able to spin a spur-of-the-moment tale so convincingly that she was able to talk a police officer out of giving her a ticket for the infraction. And once again, just like with her story about the cell phone charger, she'd told Ryan Burns one thing and law enforcement another. With these two competing versions revealing her untruthfulness, it seemed evident that Arias had removed both license plates before she arrived at Travis's house in Mesa in the early morning hours of June 4th. This would have made it difficult for anyone to identify the vehicle should it have been seen at or near Travis's house. She had apparently never put the front license plate back on the car and had remounted the back one upside down, leading to the stop by Officer Gallietti. After my conversations with Burns and Gallietti, I made the decision that I was going to call both of them to testify, and, as required by the rules, I filed a notice letting defense counsel know of my intention. As with every other potential prosecution witness, defense counsel indicated that they wished to speak to Burns and Gallietti so that they could ask them questions and tape record their answers. Rather than inconvenience the two individuals with a trip to Arizona, I informed defense counsel Lawrence Nurmi that the interviews would take place in Utah, and as is my normal practice, I would also be present during the interviews, not to interrupt or question, but simply to observe. The conversation Nurmi had with Ryan Burns was conducted in an interview room at the West Jordan City Police Department. Nurmi was a hulking man with close-cropped hair and rimmed glasses. He was dressed casually in contrast to my dress shirt and tie, and he had a legal pad in front of him that he would refer to while asking questions, along with a tape recorder. Burns was in his late 20s, approximately 6 feet tall, with red hair and green eyes. We all sat at the table, and I began the dialogue by thanking Burns for coming. I let him know that Mr. Nurmi was one of the lawyers for Jody Arias and wanted to ask him some questions. During these kinds of interviews, my attention is always focused on the witness, not defense counsel, as I am looking to see their demeanor and style in answering questions, as well as their level of composure. Burns had an air of confidence, and I sensed that he would tell the story as he remembered it without being unduly influenced by the question. Nothing emerged from Burns's interview that was of a surprising nature, except I realized that he was 3 years younger than Arias. I wasn't timing the interview, but it seemed like about 30 minutes had passed when Nurmi indicated that he had no more questions, and I let Burns know the interview was over and again thanked him for making himself available. That same morning, Nurmi also interviewed 4 other potential witnesses who were either acquaintances of Arias's or had interacted with her on June 5, 2008, when she traveled to Utah. Among those interviewed was a woman named Leslie Udy. Udy lived in the Salt Lake City area and had met Arias through prepaid legal. On the evening of June 5, 2008, Udy, Arias, Burns, and a few others had dined at Chili's. Arias had driven her to the restaurant that night and told Udy that she and Travis weren't together anymore, but she could imagine them both married to other people and socializing at PPL events where their kids would play together. Our next interview was at the Cottonwood Heights Police Department, about 10 miles away, where Officer Michael Gallietti now worked. Nurmi and I drove in separate cars, and he apparently got lost on the way because he was approximately 30 minutes late. When he finally arrived, Nurmi apologized to Officer Gallietti, who ushered us into a room just inside the lobby. Nurmi and I sat down, turned on our tape recorders, and the interview began. This interview was also short, just about 30 minutes, with Nurmi asking Gallietti about the circumstances of the traffic stop. Officer Gallietti was in uniform and appeared to be in his late 50s. He was poised in his responses and confident of his information. He came across as someone who was observant and paid close attention to details and could still remember what happened when he made a traffic stop of the car driven by Jody Arias. I'd initially called Ryan Burns to talk about his sexual interaction with Arias and ended up learning something about the traffic stop. But that's how cases are. There is always a dash of luck in every one of them, and this one was proving no different. I'd found something compelling, another part of the plan in Arias's scheme to kill Travis. Taken with everything else I'd learned, it was clear that this was not a crime of passion where Arias just reacted or the situation got out of control. This was a killing that had been well thought out to include such fine details as removing license plates to avoid being detected. This was premeditation down to the last gallon of gas. Chapter 13. I had almost missed the signposts on Jody Arias's road to Mesa, but I was now beginning to understand what fueled her motivation for the road trip to Arizona. Her overnight journey across the desert that June 4th wasn't to enjoy the weather. The high in Pasadena was around 70 degrees, while in Mesa it was slightly over 100. Arias wasn't coming to visit friends, either. She hid her itinerary from others. It most certainly wasn't a religious pilgrimage. She didn't even stop at the Mormon temple. It went beyond hiding a visit to enjoy a sexual tryst, no matter how much premarital sex was forbidden by her religion. The trip was a journey that would bring permanent closure to her relationship with Travis. She was going to end it by ending his life. Bringing 3 gas cans was just one part of her elaborate plan. To avoid missing any of her steps, I took a synergistic approach and detailed on my legal pad all the key elements leading to the killing. I had familiarized myself with this case to the point where I was intimate with the details of the investigation and could rely on that memory to formulate a timeline of Arias's preparations to carry out the murder. The trial was still a few months away, but preparation on this scale doesn't happen overnight. I started working on evenings and weekends when everyone was out of the office and I didn't have to worry about being interrupted. The office was hushed in a way that only happens after hours, and as I sat down at my desk, I turned around and looked out the window at the 4th Avenue jail with its visitors streaming in to see the inmates. Looking outside was only a momentary distraction before turning my attention to the blank legal pad in front of me to begin summarizing the steps Arias had taken in premeditating Travis's murder. Arias's planning for the trip to Arizona had started in mid to late May, with the call to her ex-boyfriend Daryl Brewer requesting to borrow gas cans. This was the call that ended with her becoming frustrated with him for asking why she needed the cans. Even though she'd hung up without giving him a definitive schedule to pick up the containers, this call marked the first outward sign that Arias's plan had been put into motion. From there, she moved on to obtaining the gun. On Wednesday, May 28, 2008, she found that she had the house to herself for approximately 5 hours, and she used this opportunity to stage the break-in at her grandparents' house on Pine Street in Yreka, where she was living. Her objective was to take the .25 caliber handgun that belonged to her grandfather. This handgun would never be recovered, but the bullet casing found in Travis's bathroom matched the caliber of her grandfather's gun. During the investigation, Arias would confirm to Detective Flores that Travis did not own a gun, 25 caliber or otherwise, which showed that Arias had used the gun stolen from her grandparents' house to kill Travis, disposing of it after the crime. Around the same time as the break-in, Arias followed up with Daryl Brewer and called him again asking to borrow the 2 gas cans for her trip to Mesa. In a few days' time, she would show up at Brewer's house and take the containers with her. Her desire to travel in early June 2008 was not born out of a need to take time off from a job following months of hard work. She had only been employed for 1 week before her road trip. As she wrote in her journal, "Speaking of Casa Ramos, last night, Monday, May 26th, 2008, was my first night. It was cool. Everybody seems nice. I think I'll like it there." Arias came up with a cover story for taking the trip. She was going to visit Ryan Burns, a man she barely knew in West Jordan, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. She mentioned Burns in a journal entry of May 27, 2008. "He's fun to flirt with through text messaging, but hey, I like this guy. Well, so far, what I know about him, I like." 3 days later, on May 30th, Arias's journal entry spoke of her decision to travel to Utah to see Burns in the coming days. But according to her, "He doesn't seem overly interested in me, although he seems happy that I am coming out to see him." It was perplexing that Arias had told her younger sister, Angela, that she saw Burns as her soulmate and future husband, yet apparently she wasn't even sure if he was interested in her in a romantic way. Burns told police that the two agreed that he would wait for her to arrive at his place sometime in the morning on Wednesday, June 4th. Arias rented a car for her supposed trip to Utah on June 2, 2008, at the airport in Redding, a city approximately 90 miles south of Yreka. The person renting her the car remembered the transaction and, after identifying Arias in a photographic lineup, mentioned that her hair was blonde when he first met her. The picture in the lineup was Arias's mugshot taken after her arrest when her hair was brown. During her interaction with the rental car agent, she made up a story and told him that she was just going to be using the car for driving around locally. The first car offered to her had been red, but she had refused it because it might be more noticeable to law enforcement, deciding instead on a white Ford Focus. Obviously, any encounter with Arizona police would prove fatal to her plan of driving into and out of the state undetected. According to the only undated entry in any of her journals, Arias spent that evening, the first night of the trip, going out to dinner with one of her ex-boyfriends, Matthew McCartney, singing karaoke after meeting him at the Red Room in Santa Cruz. She wrote that McCartney bullied her into singing a duet to the song Cruisin'. She complained in the journal, "Not that I'm any better, but I totally carried him through that song." Even though Arias had told Detective Flores during her interview in Yreka that she was ambidextrous, I had come to understand that she only issued left-handed compliments, such as her pointing out that although saying McCartney could sing, it was her performance that carried the day. The next morning, June 3rd, Arias showed up at Daryl Brewer's house in Pacific Grove near Monterey at approximately 7:30 in the morning. She had breakfast with Brewer and his young son. Once they were done eating, Arias used Brewer's computer to check her email. She then took the 2 5-gallon gas cans and left. Arias stopped at the Washington Mutual branch office in Monterey and engaged in 3 bank transactions, the last one at 10:15 a.m. There was an approximately 4-hour gap between that transaction and the next time police were able to pick up her movements, based on a few time-stamped selfies she took en route to Salinas. Those photographs were found by police on her cell phone after her arrest. Because of the changing scenery outside her car window, it appears she was sitting behind the wheel of her rental car and driving while she took these selfies, the first of which was snapped at 2:12 p.m. What made them so significant was that they showed Arias as a brunette, which meant that at some time after she rented the car at the airport in Reading, she had dyed her hair from blonde to brown. A half-smile is evident in two of the three pictures, while the last displays Arias's more serious side. But all three show her brown hair spilling past her neck and shoulders. Arias's next documented stop on June 3rd was Salinas, where she visited the Walmart at around 3:25 p.m. She purchased five items that afternoon, including another 5-gallon gas can to add to the two she had borrowed from Daryl Brewer. Her trip then took her to Pasadena, where she stopped at the Arco station shortly after 8:30 p.m. and filled both her gas tank and the three gas cans. Arias had ensured that the three containers would hold enough gasoline to guarantee she would not have to stop for gas in Arizona, so the police would not be able to place her in the state. She had also saved those gasoline receipts, which, according to her, would support her claim that she had traveled directly from California to Utah. Making sure that her alibi was still in place, Arias called Ryan Burns sometime around 9 p.m. She assured him that she was on her way to Utah to see him and would be there in the late morning of the following day, June 4th, as previously discussed. What she didn't tell him was that she was going to drive through the night to visit Travis. She placed the call to this boyfriend in waiting shortly before she headed east on Interstate 10 toward Mesa. Not long after, on the night of June 3rd, Arias powered off her cell phone. She did not turn it back on until approximately 24 hours later in northern Arizona near the Nevada border, which ensured that police would not be able to electronically trace her detour. Arias's plan of driving through Arizona undetected was successful. No one remembered seeing either a brown-haired woman entering the house in Mesa in the early morning hours of June 4th or a white Ford Focus parked in Travis's driveway. Tired from a long night of driving, Arias went to bed with Travis, waking up at around 1 p.m. I knew from the timestamps on the nude photographs that they began taking sexually explicit pictures at around 1:30 p.m. After this initial bedroom session in the mid-afternoon, Arias and Travis went downstairs, where they tried to look through the CDs of photos that she had brought with her of their travels. CDs whose very presence demonstrated that she had planned to visit Travis. The pair then had sex again before Travis, sometime shortly before 5:30 p.m., decided to take a shower, with Arias documenting his final moments on his Sanyo camera. The first stab wound ushering him to his death came while Travis was seated on the shower floor, followed by more stab wounds, which caused Travis to raise his hands to defend himself. He stood up and struggled to the sink, where Arias continued to stab him repeatedly on his shoulders. In an attempt to get away from the onslaught, Travis made his way down the hall, where Arias caught up with him and slit his throat as he was about to go into the bedroom. She continued the attack by dragging his body down the hallway to the blood-stained sink, where she shot him once in the head. She then continued to drag his body, finally stuffing Travis into the shower. It was at this point that Arias began the cleanup at the scene. She turned the shower on to wash away any biological evidence from Travis's body that could be tested later by DNA analysis. She took a plastic tumbler out from under the sink and used it to pour water on the floor in an attempt to clean some of the blood in the hallway. She then used one of the gold-brown bath towels in the bathroom to soak up some of the watered-down mixture. Retreating from the bathroom, she took the bloody towel along with the linens from Travis's bed and went downstairs to put them into the washing machine. She also placed the camera into the washer after having deleted the pictures of their sexual activity, those of Travis in the shower, and the inadvertent photos showing her dragging him down the hallway. After dumping in some bleach, she began the wash cycle. Before she left Travis's house, she removed her blood-stained socks, which she is seen wearing in one of the inadvertent photographs retrieved from the camera's memory card, and left with the knife and the gun. Neither of those weapons has been found. She walked out of the house and resumed her trip to Utah, using the gasoline stored in the 3 gas cans to fill her car along the way. It wasn't until she was near the Nevada border that she turned on her phone and called Ryan Burns to tell him that she'd gotten lost and would be arriving one day later. Her explanation for not arriving in Utah until June 5th was not questioned by Burns or her other acquaintances. She told them that she had taken the wrong freeway and driven for many hours. She also claimed to have stopped and slept for a long time. Arias was self-deprecating, blaming herself for getting lost, and even called herself an airhead. That same day, almost immediately after arriving at Ryan Burns's home in West Jordan, she was stopped for a traffic violation because her back license plate was upside down. Arias's meticulous approach extended to the cleanup of the rental car before returning it to the rental agency in Redding. She removed the front and back floor mats before turning the car in, presumably because they might have had blood or other evidence on them that could have linked her to the crime. She also disposed of the 3 gas cans. Neither the mats nor the gas cans have ever been found. I also intended to call the jury's attention to the 3 communications Arias made to Travis, the June 4th voice message she left on his cell phone, the June 6th text message, and the June 7th email, showing that she'd tried to cover up her involvement in the murder by making it seem as though she and Travis hadn't seen each other in a while. For almost 4 years, I had endured Arias's changing her story as she shifted her version of events to fit the evidence. I had always known that I would need something concrete that she could not explain away to confront her with at trial. In this high-stakes game of poker that she was playing, I had found my ace in the hole with the gas cans. And the best part was that she would not learn about them until she was on the witness stand and it was too late for her to again change her story in an attempt to explain them away. Chapter 14. Trial strategy isn't a matter of simply calling a witness to the stand, asking questions, and showing pictures to the jury. It's about making difficult decisions regarding who will be called as a witness and what evidence to present, along with the order in which each will be introduced. Choosing when to present a piece of evidence to a jury is almost more important than the evidence itself, as the timing can affect the way a jury may treat it. Introducing a fact too soon can cause them to miss its importance, while introducing it too late runs the risk of having jurors disregard it, as their minds may already be made up. This is the fine line I had to walk in the Jody Arias case. The trial had already been rescheduled a number of times before the judge set a firm date of December 10, 2012, for the start of jury selection. I'd been preparing for this since my walkthrough of the crime scene on June 10, 2008. Preparation isn't something that I do all at once, but rather it's a gradual and ongoing process as I refine my thinking about each witness and decide the best approach to maximize the impact of their testimony. In this case, my most important decision was deciding when I was going to introduce the information that Arias had utilized 3 gas cans to hide her trip into Arizona. Prosecutors are trained to present their most compelling evidence as part of their opening remarks, as a way to signal to the jury the most significant aspects of their case. Under normal circumstances, I would have included the information about the gas cans in my opening statement and made it a part of my case in chief. But I did not want to give Arias time to formulate a story explaining why it was necessary for her to take 3 gas cans on her trip. My plan was to wait until the opportune time to reveal their existence. That would be when the defense was presenting its case and called Daryl Brewer to the stand. Arizona law does not limit cross-examination of a witness to questions about issues raised during the direct examination. Once the defense called Brewer to testify, my intention on cross-examination was to have him confirm that he lent Arias the 2 5-gallon gas cans for use during her trip. Having this information come from Brewer would make it harder for Arias to deny that she had made the request and that she had told Brewer her intended destination was Mesa. This approach was extremely risky. I was relying on defense counsel to call a witness, but there was always a chance that they would choose not to have Brewer testify, even though his name was on their witness list. He was merely an ex-boyfriend who had lived with Arias and could speak about how she got along with him and his young son, which didn't make him crucial to Arias's self-defense claim. To ensure that defense counsel and Jody Arias herself did not know of my desire to have Brewer take the stand, I went out of my way to appear uninterested in him as a witness. Just as defense counsel has the right to interview all potential witnesses to be called by the prosecution, I have the same right with any of the defense's potential witnesses. I made a conscious decision not to request an interview with Brewer prior to trial, although I conducted interviews with every other person on the defense's list of potential witnesses. If the defense ultimately decided not to call Brewer, I knew I could still raise the issue of the gas cans in my cross-examination of Jody Arias, but relying on that as a backup strategy was even riskier. Without Brewer's testimony framing the story, it would be easy for her to deny borrowing them, leaving me worse off than if I had never broached the subject. My decision would be further complicated if I then wanted to call Brewer as a witness to rebut her denial. Brewer lived in California, and the subpoena power of an Arizona court to compel his appearance as a witness extended only as far as the state border. I could request that a California court order him to travel to Arizona and give testimony, but that would take time. There would be no way to guarantee that he would be able to appear before the trial ended. And even if I could get Arias to admit that she bought a gas can at the Walmart in Salinas by showing her the receipt, that admission alone would prove nothing, because 1 5-gallon can of gasoline was not enough to get her through Arizona without stopping and filling up. There was another drawback to my strategy, which was that the defense could choose to call Brewer after calling Arias. Usually, defendants taking the stand in their defense go on last, but that isn't always the case. My strategy regarding the gas cans would be more powerful if Brewer testified before Arias. If the order were reversed and Arias went on before Brewer, I'd be forced to ask her about the gas cans first, which would not be as impactful as having Brewer lay out a story that she could not refute. Hoping the defense would call Brewer to the stand before Arias was a gamble, but it was one I was willing to take because it was my best chance of exposing Arias's self-defense claim as a sham. Another decision I needed to make was when to introduce the 3 attempts Arias made to contact Travis after she killed him. These messages were additional pieces of evidence that I would wait to present during the defense case. Their existence had already been disclosed to defense counsel, and while presumably Arias was aware of them, she didn't know when I was going to use them. Because I had anticipated that Arias was going to testify in her own defense, I decided that asking her about the text, voice message, and email on cross-examination would be much more powerful than introducing them during the presentation of my case. Waiting until Arias was on the stand to ask about these 3 communications would force her to explain why she sent them if she knew that Travis was already dead. The other important decision I had to make was how forcefully I would approach Arias when she took the stand. Long before the trial started, I had decided that I was going to question her aggressively if she made good on her promise to 48 hours that she would testify. From my close viewing of Arias's interviews with Detective Flores, I'd seen what could happen if she was given space to get comfortable. In the span of 2 interviews with him, she'd told 3 different stories about Travis's murder. If that weren't reason enough to be cautious, the forgery of the Bob White letters was a strong indication of the lengths that she would go if unchecked. I could not afford to give her any room to believe she could manipulate the truth on the stand by taking advantage of an easygoing style. Even when backed into a corner, she still seemed comfortable, so my intent was to get her out of her comfort zone, to keep her off balance and under pressure. I knew from experience that there are a couple of ways to do this. One comes from the pace of the questions, the other from the tone of voice. I'd planned both carefully in the years leading up to the trial. Although the use of this aggressive approach would make it harder for Arias to come up with answers on the spot and keep them consistent with the many stories she had told, there was also the chance that this style could backfire with the jury. Arias's argument was that she had been victimized by Travis, so a harsh approach could be seen as another instance of a man in her life mistreating her. But in the end, I had no doubt that my approach was the right one, and under the circumstances, it was a risk I had to take. Arizona is one of the few states that permits jurors to submit questions in writing, which may be asked of the witness after the lawyers have completed their questioning. This procedure for asking jurors questions differs in that the judge is the person who reads the questions to the witness. After the judge finishes reading the questions, the party calling the witness may follow up on issues raised by the juror's questions. The opposing party is then afforded the last opportunity to question the witness, which is significant because the last thing the jury will hear will be answers to the opposing counsel's questions. This meant that when Arias testified, as I anticipated she would, I would have the last word, with her potentially providing me the opportunity to have the third gas can issue be the last thing the jury would hear discussed with Arias before she left the witness stand. With the presentation of my case, my aim was to keep the jury's attention focused on the horrific nature of the killing. This would be a challenge because the defendant was a woman. Some would even think she was attractive. And juries historically associate brutality as endemic to a man. So I needed to have them look past the stereotype and just consider the evidence. Similarly, I wanted the jury to see beyond Travis's faults, to make them focus on what she had done to him, not on the way he had spoken and written to her. I was not going to hide that he was human and had his shortcomings, but I wasn't going to linger on them either. If I was not careful and became too focused on protecting Travis's character, I might turn the trial into a rehabilitative exercise rather than proving that Arias had planned and carried out his murder. While it would have been easy to try to dwell on Travis's Mormon faith, his work history at PPL, or his relative youth, none of those things were what this case was about. It was about a scorned woman who exacted revenge for Travis's failure to choose her. But taking his life had not been enough. In her continuing effort, Arias had taken her character assault of Travis to a new level with yet another disturbing allegation, that Travis was a pedophile. She was now claiming that she had walked in on him on January 21, 2008, while he was masturbating to pictures of young children. She recounted that the pictures were on the bed while Travis was touching himself. According to her, he had always been verbally abusive, but after she caught him that day, he became physically abusive as well. Arias described three occasions when she claimed that Travis had struck her. She said the first occurred in October 2007 when they were arguing and he pushed her down on the ground to prevent her from leaving the bedroom. The second supposedly happened at Travis's house, where he threw her down on the floor and kicked her, breaking a finger on her left hand. The last incidence of alleged violence was when he struck her while she was staying at his house immediately before her move to Wairika. According to Arias, he threw her down on the ground, got on top of her, and choked her until she passed out. Arias's uncorroborated allegation that Travis was a pedophile appeared to gratuitous character assassination that raised the already inflammatory tone of her defense to a higher level. The introduction of this latest allegation smacked of desperation, because it appeared she had nothing to support her claim other than her word. This was an untenable position, as she had devalued her credibility with all the stories she'd already told, so I wasn't going to deviate from my strategy of waiting to expose her use of the 3 gas cans as part of her scheme to kill Travis. Proving the first-degree murder charge required that I show that Arias was the one who killed Travis and that she had premeditated his killing, and the place to start was by showing what had happened in the master bedroom suite on June 4th, 2008. I had a choice of whom I was going to call to set the crime scene, which involved explaining to the jury the date, time, and circumstances under which Travis's body was found. This is usually done through the testimony of either a police officer who had responded to the emergency call or detectives responding to the scene. But I wanted to start my presentation of evidence with a more impactful witness. I could have called Travis's roommate, Zachary Billings, to offer testimony about his role in the discovery of his friend's body, but I wanted a broader picture painted through my first witness and instead chose to call Mimi Hall. Mimi was a Mormon woman and Travis's friend, someone he had dated for a brief time. She was also the person he had invited to accompany him on a trip to Cancun, Mexico, which appeared to be the motive that spurred Arias to kill Travis. He had never asked Arias to go with him on that trip, and she had tried to act as if not being chosen to accompany him hadn't bothered him, to the point that she had gone to the other extreme of telling Detective Flores that she was planning to ask Travis if she could stay at his house during the time he was in Mexico. Mimi Hall would be able to describe the circumstances that led her to Travis's house the night his body was eventually found. She was also knowledgeable about the Mormon religion and would discuss aspects of the faith, including the prohibition against premarital sex, which applies equally to all members regardless of gender. Continuing the crime scene story would be witnesses from the Mesa Police Department, because they had carried out the investigation and could speak to the specifics of how Travis was killed. Officer Sterling Williams was the first officer on the scene and would describe the signs of decomposition he observed on the body when he found it. His observations would support the notion that the killing had occurred days before the body was discovered. Of course, I would also call Detective Flores to testify. He was the lead investigator in the case, who was familiar with every aspect of the investigation. He kept track of the roles of other officers involved in the case, submitted items for testing, such as DNA and fingerprint analysis, and would sit next to me at the prosecution table throughout the trial. His time on the stand was going to be broken down into segments rather than having him complete his testimony in one sitting. I planned to call him to provide testimony about such things as Arias's in-person and telephone statements to him over the course of the investigation, her appearance on Inside Edition, and details about Arias's arrest and the search of Travis's home. I would not be presenting all of her statements at one time, as I had found that video or audio statements played one right after the other have a tendency to run together and be confusing to the jury, which could lessen their impact. The other reason for truncating Flores's appearances on the witness stand was that he could fill gaps of time that normally occur during trial because of witness scheduling conflicts. Juries do not appreciate when their time is wasted waiting for a witness to appear, or when the court day ends early because the next witness is not available until the next day. As case agent, Detective Flores would be present in court and available to testify at a moment's notice, so it wouldn't be an inconvenience or waste of time for him, and there would be no dead time for the jury. Another member of the Mesa Police Department who would testify was Heather Connor, a technician experienced in finding latent prints at a scene and comparing them to a suspect's prints. Connor had collected a left palm print in blood from the west wall of the bathroom hallway and determined that the latent palm print was Arias's, establishing that Arias had been in Travis's house. That her palm print was on the west wall, where one of the retrieved inadvertent photographs showed Arias's foot at Travis's head as blood runs down his right shoulder, would go far in removing any doubt that the jury might have that someone other than Arias had killed Travis. Heather Connor had also been present when the hundreds of photographs were taken of the crime scene, documenting the body, bathroom, and master bedroom from every angle. It would have been counterproductive to show every one of those photographs to the jury, so I spent days narrowing the number that I would introduce down to 140. The photographs I selected showed the entirety of the scene, which would help the jury understand how the killing occurred and also help them appreciate the pain and anguish inflicted by Arias on Travis. Although photographs accurately depict the size and relationship between items, they are not a life-size representation, which is why I like to bring in the actual object or documents whenever possible. I had spent a great deal of time going through the items that had been collected as part of the investigation. In looking at the piece of carpet that had been cut from the master bedroom showing the ovoid bloodstain, I was surprised to see how much larger the pattern was than I remembered it from my walkthrough. Because the carpet swatch had been cut from the floor, I was able to look underneath it and notice that the blood on the underside appeared diluted, just like the blood on the side of the cardboard box sitting on the floor of the bathroom linen closet. It was obvious that Arias had used the plastic tumbler to apply water to that area of the carpet in an attempt to manipulate the scene by cleaning the blood. I realized that the actual section of carpet would be far more impactful to the jury than an 8.5 by 11 inch photograph, giving them an understanding of how profusely Travis was bleeding as Arias chased him down and slit his throat at the end of the hallway. Another item from the house that caught my eye was the goldish-brown bath towel that police had found in the washing machine. It was the mate to the one I had seen hanging in Travis's bathroom, although this one was now discolored in spots from having gone through the wash cycle with bleach. It seemed clear that Arias had been the one to put it in the washing machine with the bleach to remove any biological material she may have left behind. So if a DNA test were done, there would be no evidence to show she was there. This would be significant for the jury to consider when assessing Arias's claim that she was confused and could not remember much about the attack or her actions after she killed Travis. Also important was that one of the goldish-brown towels had been found in the washing machine next to the camera, which indicated that Arias appeared to believe that adding bleach would destroy the photographs linking her to the crime, which would help answer for the jury the question of why she had failed to take the camera with her when she left Travis's house that day. Once the police photographer finished taking pictures, investigators from the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner had come in and placed the body in a bag to remove it from the crime scene for examination by Kevin Horn, M.D., a doctor with that office. As Dr. Horn would describe, Arias first stabbed Travis in the chest, then slashed his throat, finally ending her attack with a shot to Travis's right temple. He would also tell the jury that Travis was conscious for the first part of the attack and tried to protect himself from the knife, as indicated by the defensive wounds on his hands. To avoid any confusion about the caliber of the casing found near the sink area, I intended to call Elizabeth Northcutt, a forensic firearms examiner with the Mesa Police Department. She examined the casing found in the blood in front of the sink and determined it was .25 caliber. She also examined the bullet fragment recovered by Dr. Horn from Travis's head and found that it was consistent in weight with a .25 caliber round. Northcutt would also speak to the difference between a revolver, which does not eject the casings after the bullet is fired, and a semi-automatic handgun, which extracts and ejects the casings, and is the kind of gun that was used to shoot Travis in the face. I knew that Detective Flores would be grilled about an assertion he made at a court hearing very early in the case that was at odds with Dr. Kevin Horn's findings. That hearing was to determine whether there was probable cause to believe that the killing was especially cruel, addressing whether Travis suffered emotionally or physically as a result of being stabbed and shot. I had called Flores to testify and reprise Dr. Horn's opinion as to the sequence of the fatal injuries leading to Travis's death. My decision to call Flores instead of Horn was an acknowledgement of how busy Horn's schedule was at the time. There was a shortage of doctors at the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner, and I knew that the rules allowed for Flores to testify based on what Horn might have told him. Detective Flores does not have any medical experience, and his knowledge of the sequence of events was predicated on a very brief phone conversation with Dr. Horn that took place a couple of days before the hearing. It was unclear whether Horn understood what Flores was asking, but the end result was that Flores interpreted what he heard to mean the shot to Travis's temple happened before the stab wounds. The defense had raised this inconsistency in prior pleadings, so I was sure they would raise it again at trial. It was a point of little consequence, because no one could dispute that Travis suffered extreme physical pain and emotional distress, as shown by the defensive wounds on his hands. I hoped defense counsel would continue to focus on this inconsistency rather than spend time on the self-defense claim. Corroborating the testimony of Dr. Horn would be forensic chemist Lisa Perry of the Mesa Police Department, a blood spatter expert who could detail Travis's movements during the attack based on the blood patterns in the bathroom. Her opinion was that the attack began in the shower, where Travis's blood was first shed, and moved to the sink area, where Arias repeatedly stabbed him in the back as he stood over the vanity. Somehow, Travis made his way down the hall toward the master bedroom until collapsing at the doorway, where his throat was slashed. Arias dragged him back down the hallway to the sink area, where she shot him in the face, with the ejected casing landing on blood already pooling on the floor. Perry's testimony would be offered to help fill the gaps left by the thick fog that prevented Arias from remembering most of what happened during the attack. Testimony from Jody Legg, a forensic chemist with the Mesa Police Department, would be another scientific piece in proving that Arias was the person who murdered Travis. Legg had examined the biological evidence collected at the scene and found a mixture of Travis's and Arias's blood on the hair and the bloody palm print found on the wall in the hallway. The significance of this was that it placed Arias at the scene at the time of the killing, when blood was being shed. Perhaps the most important pieces of evidence during my case were the deleted photographs that Mesa Police Detective Michael Melendez retrieved from the memory card of Travis's camera. The photographs helped prove that Arias was the person who killed Travis on the afternoon of June 4, 2008. And at least two of those pictures showed how she dragged his limp body down the hallway after she rendered him unconscious. If there was any doubt as to her identity, the photos of their afternoon sexual foray showed not only her private parts, but her face as well. Melendez would also discuss the photos of Travis in the shower, which established that he and Arias were still together in the late afternoon at 5:30 p.m., minutes before Travis was killed, as shown in the three inadvertent photographs. Once Arias was shown to be the killer, the emphasis of my presentation would shift to proving that she premeditated the murder. Though I would only bring up the gas cans and the three messages she sent to Travis after his death during my cross-examination of Arias, I still had several pieces of evidence that I was going to introduce during my case in chief to demonstrate her planning of the murder. I would call witnesses to testify to the change of Arias's hair color, her selection of a rental car location that was far away from Wairika, her removal of the floor mats from the rental car, her theft of the gun from her grandparents' home, turning off her phone to avoid being tracked, and her removal of the license plates from the rental car. The testimony of Detective Nathan Mendez of the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office would serve to point out other steps Arias had taken in furtherance of her plan to kill Travis. Detective Mendez held one of the keys to establishing the foundation for my theory about the gas cans, and through his testimony I intended to introduce a photograph of the Airwalk shoebox found in Arias's bedroom at her grandparents' house and the 22 receipts from Arius's trip that had been found inside. He had been one of the officers who assisted the Mesa Police Department in the execution of the search warrant on the Pine Street home on July 15, 2008, and could speak to the items that had been found. My plan was to ask him about the receipts while he was on the stand in an expeditious fashion, almost as if they were an afterthought, so once they were in evidence I could come back to them later, after I had introduced the borrowing of the gas cans through my cross-examination of Daryl Brewer. Through Detective Mendez's testimony, I also wanted to show that Arius's decision to rent a car at the budget counter at the airport in Redding, located 90 minutes from Yreka instead of from one of the two local rental agencies, Hertz and Enterprise, was a deliberate act to avoid being recognized. Officer Mendez was the detective who had assembled the photo lineup that included the booking photo of Arius. He had shown it to the budget rental agency employee, Rafael Colombo, on July 17, 2008, and would testify to Colombo's positive identification of Arius and to his statement that she was a blonde when she rented the car from him on June 2, 2008. Like Mendez, Colombo would travel from California to testify about his interactions with Arius when she rented the vehicle and when she returned it to the counter at the Redding airport. He would confirm his immediate selection of Arius from the photo lineup and that her hair was blonde when she rented the car. Colombo would also testify about his observations when Arius returned the car on June 7th with four missing floor mats and an unanticipated number of miles on the odometer. Officer Kevin Friedman of the Yreka Police Department would speak to his role in the investigation of the purported burglary of Arius's grandparents' house on May 28, 2008, during which her grandfather's 25-caliber semi-automatic handgun was reportedly taken. Arius's traffic stop in West Jordan, Utah, would be introduced through the testimony of Officer Michael Gallietti, who would describe how he pulled her over after observing that her rear license plate was upside down. Ryan Burns stood out as an example of Arius's pattern of chasing love from state to state, and was illustrative of her tendency to jump into a relationship and imagine it being more than it was. Burns would testify that Arius was calm when she arrived in Utah after the murder, and he could speak to her aggressive pursuit of sexual intimacy almost immediately upon her arrival in Utah. This emerging picture of Arius was at odds with her self-portrayal as a woman who submitted herself sexually to the whims of men. Burns would also indicate that he was familiar with the route between Los Angeles and Salt Lake City, which was a straight drive north on Interstate 15 all the way to Utah, with no need to exit the freeway. Burns could also refute any claim that Arius was either on the road to Utah or with him at the time of the killing. He was the person who initially